Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us. As promised, Father Tad Boholczyk is here with us. And you often hear when people call and ask a question about care in a hospital or end-of-life care or care for a prenatal child or all kinds of issues like that, you'll hear us refer them to the National Catholic Bioethics Center. We trust them to know a lot of stuff that we don't know, and also we trust them to give an answer that comports fully with the teaching of the Catholic Church. And Father Tad is the Director of Education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Father, thank you for being here with us.
Great to join you, as always. I look forward to the time together here.
By the way, if you have a question about any of those things that I just mentioned, you want to talk about life in any of its stages, about the proper treatment of human beings, the proper treatment of bodies, you are very welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. And I was just wondering this just before we went on the air, because there's something I want to ask you about, but I want to ask you just personally as someone who has devoted his life to this stuff, and some of it has a pretty high horror factor to it. Do you have to have a good ability to just go home and like take a deep breath and let it go? Because it's some of this stuff is awful that's going on.
Well, that's true. I think, I don't know exactly how to answer that, except to say you run into some very weird stuff and then it gets still weirder yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just kind of, I think at a certain point, maybe you develop a little bit of a shield, you know, you just get used to some of it. And that's a shame. I think, you know, this is what we call the slippery slope, that people kind of do bad things and then they start doing even worse things and they don't even realize that it's connected to the fact that they did the first ones. So maybe for me, you know, working in this area, I develop a little bit of insensitivity, but I try not to, you know,
do my best
to stay in touch with the basic moral intuitions here that need to guide us.
Well, you do a great service for us, and I'll give you one that gives me that feeling of, I'll be honest with you, it kind of gives me this feeling, like, I'm glad that sometime the Lord is going to call me home, and I will just get to be at rest with him, because now people are creating synthetic human embryos. It just feels awful. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I know what you mean about the thought of being called home and sort of getting away from the craziness.
Yeah.
So what this involves is scientists, as you know, have been studying stem cells taken out of destroyed embryos for many years now. The first time they did that was back in 1998. They got the first bunch of stem cells from a human embryo. And as time has gone on, they've figured out that they can take these cells and with a little bit of genetic modifications, they can kind of cobble them together. And what happens is the cells sort of hang on to each other, aggregate together, and they can actually reconstitute a human embryo, or at least they're calling it a synthetic human embryo, or some people are calling it stembryos because it's from stem cells,
okay.
Stembryos. And these embryos are, well, how to say it? I mean, they appear to be pretty good replicas of the real deal. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that these scientists are able to take them, grow them in culture, and they will continue to grow for, believe it or not, 14 days. And in that time period, they will be elucidating all the proper structures, you know, the proper layers will be developing, the primordia for different organs look like they are, you know, beginning to be laid out, etc. So it raises a lot of concerns, because what the scientists are saying is, look, we're just making a model here. This is not a real embryo. Don't you worry. We're only going to be doing this to figure out, for example, why miscarriages happen. And yet, if they can do this well enough that this grows in a manner that's almost indistinguishable from the way that a regular embryo grow, then, you know, you ask this old question, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, you know, is it a duck? It sure looks like a duck. It sure looks like an embryo. There's a lot of concern around this, and there are a number of ethicists who are commenting on it and just saying, think about what the goal is here. The goal for these researchers is to make a super excellent replica of a human embryo. Well, so what if you could make an actual human embryo? That would be the perfect replica because it would be the real deal. And that's where we seem to be heading. You know, to the extent that the scientists figure out how to do a few more tweaks and get everything just right. And they may have already done that. So, I mean, one more point here, just kind of to throw into the mix. A lot of times when people talk about making embryos, they'll say, well, don't worry, we won't implant them into a woman's uterus. We won't try to make anybody get pregnant. So, well, that sounds good, but the issue here is not whether you're planning to do it, but whether you've made the kind of entity that if you did implant it, would it initiate a pregnancy? Because some of these embryos that they've grown do produce factors that are used, for example, to determine a pregnancy test. So they produce the right hormones to indicate a pregnancy, even though they're not in a uterus, they're just growing in glassware.
Oh, yeah.
So it's amazing. You know, they're really doing kind of a very sophisticated job of getting these things to be very, very similar, if not real embryos. And the other piece is you don't know, what about if you were to do an implantation into a woman's uterus and the embryo did not take, then the scientists would say, see, we told you it's not a real embryo. But it's like, well, wait a minute, that doesn't prove it, because women have miscarriages and embryos die all the time for reasons we don't understand. But those are still real embryos that died, real human beings. So, you know, it's a tricky thing here. And I
Oh, man, we are having a little bit of trouble. We keep maybe Father Tad will come right back, but we for the moment we have dropped. So I'll tell you what, I'd like to invite you to call and ask your bioethics questions. Maybe you have a particular question in the family. Those are welcome. This is one of the services that the National Catholic Bioethics Center provides. It's if you have issues at the early stages of life or in the late stages of life where you need help making decisions, or you need to know just even what the issues are. Sometimes the bioethics is so advanced now that it's hard to even know what issues are we dealing with. And maybe you'd like to call and ask Father Tad about your particular situation. Maybe you work in the medical field or in the field of science and you'd like some help knowing where the moral parameters are there. All of it is welcome. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Father, you dropped. We were getting near the end, but you had made the point that with these embryos, the synthetic embryos that are being created, it may well be that you could implant these and they would survive and you would have a fully developed pregnancy that could be brought to term. But you were saying even if it's the case that the embryo died, it doesn't mean that you didn't create a human life. It just means that there was another miscarriage.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm glad that much got through before we had our little hiccup in the line there. But yeah, that's exactly right. And I think this means that sometimes the claims of scientists about whether they have created embryos or not need to be taken with, you know, a relatively large grain of salt. And we're going to have, you know, more stringent requirements really to be able to sort this out.
But it does seem to me that what the scientist is doing, and you know this, so I would like to ask you if this is correct, if my impression is correct. It seems like that the objection that the scientist is trying to address is, look, these children are not going to be brought to term. They're not going to be born. So whatever we're doing, whatever monkeying around genetically we're doing, it's not going to find its way into the human family and become part of the genetic patrimony, you know, that could cause problems for hundreds, thousands of years down the line. That's the problem that they think is the moral question that needs to be addressed, but that they don't seem to think that the life of the person, the life of the individual embryonic human being is the thing that needs to be addressed. That's why they tell us, oh, we're not going to implant these. They're not even interested in the life of the embryonic person.
I think that's correct. And that's, you know, where we have arrived in this whole line of research, that scientists are willing, for example, to do in vitro fertilization, freeze embryos, then thaw out those embryos, use them to basically destroy them and get their stem cells. So you have a situation where it's become a commodity. It's become something you use. The human beings that are created in these situations are objects, not subjects of infinite and inestimable value, which is really what the church is always reminding us. Each person is unique. Each person is willed by God. And we shouldn't be instrumentalizing, to use that fancy word, our fellow humans.
888-318-7884 is the number. Folks are on the line, but there are several lines open. If you have bioethics questions, you don't have to be Catholic to call, by the way. Anybody can call with a bioethics question for Father Tad Boholczyk. He is a Catholic priest, but also trained as a scientist and as an ethicist. 888-318-7884 is the number. I'll just ask you one question, then I'll take a break and come back and let other folks ask you questions, and that is when the scientist says whether it's about what however they formed the embryonic life, when they say, well, we're not going to implant this, and that's supposed to reassure us that I suppose that this is that these genetic the genetic facts of this being will not get into the human line. But when you say we're not going to, it doesn't mean that the techniques you perfected aren't going to be used by someone else. The assurance is hollow, given that these are kind of that knowledge is a fungible asset. It can be moved from one place to another.
I think that's true. The real issue here, I think, is that we've got to assist scientists to step away from doing everything in humans and go back to animals, mm-hmm. because there is value to the kinds of studies they're proposing, but what they're doing is immediately jumping into the human cells and the human tissues and the human embryos, and it's like this is something relatively new. In the past, you would never do that. You would always say, we're going to start with mice, and then we'll move to other primates, eventually, and we'll be very, very careful if we ever step into the human domain. That's how drug testing is always done. You test it on mice first, then rats, then, other animals before you do human trials. So that sense of the sacredness of the human is something that's not that much anymore a part of the equation. And I would say, it's interesting, these researchers who are trying to develop these embryo models, as they call them, the synthetic embryos, they say they're doing it because of ethical concerns. They're saying, well, we can't normally use embryos. They're sort of paying lip service to it and then trying to find this alternative route. So, in theory, this represents something positive, that they seem to be at least obliquely acknowledging that ethics count, which is sometimes more than happens in some of these labs. It's more, let's just get some good results.
I got to take a break. Father Tad Boholczyk, our guest, your bioethics questions. Welcome, 888-318-7884.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 2003. EWTN foundress Mother Angelica is honored at the National Cable Telecommunications Association annual convention, where she was inducted into the Cable Television Pioneers for her significant contribution to the cable television industry.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Father Tad Boholczyk. We're always it's a great blessing to have Father Tad here. It's a great blessing to have the National Catholic Bioethics Center available. because we are in an era where things change so quickly, and the changes are not minor, but momentous in many cases. It's wonderful to have someone here who can help us through it all. If you'd like some help in the area of bioethics, 888-318-7884 is the number. We're going to start in Los Angeles, right up the road from us here in California. Michael is watching on YouTube. Michael, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Father Tad.
Thank you so much. I've read an article that China's been human.
Michael, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you got to talk right into the phone, Michael. We're not making out what you're saying.
Okay, yes. I'm curious if... do you hear me?
Yes, we do.
Okay, I was curious if an animal-human hybrid, like a chimera, would have a soul, if God would allow a soul out of the... some sort of a genetic experiment, a synthetic embryo, full grown, will have a regular human soul, or will it be something completely different?
Okay, Michael, it seems to me you actually have two questions there. One question deals with chimeras, and specifically human-animal chimeras. So those depend on the nature of what you're creating and how you're doing it. So let me give you an example. You can create a chimeric pig by taking a pig embryo and adding a few human stem cells. And what happens is those human stem cells will incorporate themselves into the pig's body. And, you know, if you're lucky, you could get them to incorporate just into the kidneys. So this pig grows up and he has human kidneys. So you slaughter them and you get your bacon, but you also get these kidneys that can be transplanted potentially. And so that kind of chimera, you know, would not raise any of the sorts of questions you're talking about. It's a genuine pig that has some, you know, human parts in it. Now, you know, there's some other concerns around that whole type of technology, which maybe we won't get into, just whether if the cells go into other places, like into the pig's brain or into the pig's gonads, then you're going to have some other ethical concerns. So scientists are trying to, you know, proceed slowly on that type of work. I mean, the second part of your question was, well, if we succeed in making these synthetic embryos that do grow beyond 14 days, and can be implanted, and one of them was to be born as a little baby, would the little baby have a soul? And the answer is definitely yes. It would be very parallel to the case of human cloning. In human cloning, what you do is you go through a series of steps where you actually don't use any sperm. You do use a woman's egg, but you don't use any sperm, and you create an identical twin of somebody who you clone. And as you know, identical twins do have souls. And just because you've done a kind of workaround on some of the biology here, you're still forming a genuine human embryo. And that embryo would have, you know, all the typical characteristics. And whenever, you know, whenever God makes that decision to ensoul, which he always does, if the biology is what it's meant to be, meaning if it is in the proper order and configuration as part of his original plan, he certainly you know, would ensoul that. I mean, there's other ways to make human beings that you might not think of as typical, and yet they clearly are human, and the same is true of animals. I always point out to people, just look at Dolly the sheep, you know, created without any sheep sperm, but she was 100%, 100.0% genuine sheep. And it would be the same thing that occurs when the biology of human origins and reproduction is sort of built up in these workaround fashions.
Michael, what do you think?
Sounds great. It just, this all sounds pretty dark. Like, I don't know if it's just moral. Scientists should be messing around with these things, but... you know, that's beyond my pay grade.
Well, let me just ask this then, because take the example of the pig that grew human kidneys. I assume, Father, that this would be a treatment for kidney failure, so you would be able to get people off of dialysis.
Right, that's correct. And if scientists manage to pull this off, you know, in the next 10, 15 years, it could have a huge impact on the number of people who die on dialysis and because of kidney failure.
Yeah, so the dark side, I guess this is the fundamental problem with a lot of this, and this is the line you're trying to help us walk, Father, is that there is a terrible dark side to many of these things, but there is also great good and potential for great good that we can't, especially because it's real human suffering. For example, to have failed kidneys is terrible human suffering. That we can't just say, oh, chuck it all. We got to stop all this science. You know, you have to. You're morally obligated to find a balanced way to proceed.
That's correct. You've got to assess these things kind of one by one. And, you know, maybe, Cy, let me just give one more flip side example of the one that I just gave so that people can see, you know, directions we should not go.
Okay.
So the pig, yeah, I mean, the pig with the kidneys, you can kind of see, all right, maybe that could work. Maybe, you know, if we make sure it doesn't go into the brain or into the gonads of the pig and only into their kidneys. But what about if you did it the other way? What if you took a human embryo and you added a small amount of pig stem cells?
Oh.
And let's say some of those stem cells incorporated into the brain of the baby, and you were intentionally trying to make a human being who was mentally deficient so that he could be worked much harder like a slave.
Holy smokes. I don't even know. That is so horrifying. One almost, but it certainly is not beyond the capacity of humans to do such things. We lack the technical skill, but we have always had the will to do those kind of things to one another. So, Father, I to take your counterfactual, Father, that seems nothing but a horror.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's the kind of case that people really do call dark and recoil when they think about it, that you're intentionally creating kind of lower life forms out of human beings. So, you know, these things, you have to discern case by case, and you have to have a clear sense of goods that you're going to be safeguarding as you move forward with science. So this is why, you know, it's really critical for scientists to get formed around the basic ethical issues. You know, a few years back, there was that fellow in China who decided to genetically modify human embryos. He went ahead and did it, but he had carried out a few discussions with some ethicists ahead of time, and they weren't able to sort of convince him not to do it, to dissuade him. And he had two Chinese little girls who were born who had been genetically modified. And, you know, there was a whole bunch of complications that followed after that in terms of him getting arrested and the scientists, you know, kind of telling him he shouldn't have done that and so on. But there's this sort of I want to be first mentality that sometimes prevails. And, you know, you can't, unless you really have formed scientists in a clear ethical vision, they'll sometimes be strongly and sorely tempted to go down these pathways.
Michael, thank you very, very much for the call. I'm going to go to Dennis in Dayton, Ohio. Dennis, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Father Tad Boholczyk.
Hi, thank you. Kind of a related question. I'm trying to understand the people who work on synthetic embryos and other types of related embryos, do they believe that they're working or that they're impacting a person, or do they view the embryo as more of an object? I'm trying to understand what their point of view might be on that.
Father?
Well, I don't know if there's a way to answer that completely in the general. I suspect there are going to be differing views among different scientists. So I think you'll have some scientists who will play with what we call the 14-day fiction, which is this claim that, well, it's all right to experiment on embryos up to 14 days, but after that, we need to be more careful because after that, they start actually developing organs. And prior to that, they don't have organs, and they certainly don't have a nervous system of any, you know, significance. And so some scientists will try to divide it along those lines. I think there will be other scientists who will just say, according to a pro-abortion mentality, you know, you don't count for anything until you're first wanted and second born and able to, you know, then be cared for by the one who wanted you, sort of thing. So some scientists probably fall into that camp. And I suspect that there's a whole range of other views around this.
Thank you very much, Dennis. I hope it was helpful to you. You can hear the music. We have to take a break. We're talking bioethics with Father Tad Boholchik. Your calls welcome. 888-318-7884. Lots of lines open right now. 888-318-7884. Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus' teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus' ministry. And it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history and the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Hi, this is Janet Williams. Please join us for Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I don't know why Carrie wants me to keep saying the word spiffy, but I have to keep saying the word spiffy in order to read this ad. At shop.catholic.com, we've got a great deal going on right now. The word spiffy is coming up, don't worry. Now that you're not going to want to miss out on. Seriously, it's awesome. Visit shop.catholic.com through midnight tonight, Hawaii time, and check out our spiffy 60 $1 book sale. Yes, I said $1 book sale. We've taken 60 of our 20 Answers titles, 30 books, 30 ebooks, and put them on sale for just a buck each. That is awesome. Go over to shop.catholic.com. Check out the Spiffy 60 category, $1 books until midnight tonight, Honolulu time. I don't like saying the word spiffy, and I think he knows that I don't like saying the word spiffy, and so he keeps making me say the word spiffy. I think I said it about 100 times right there. Our number is 888-318-7884. Talk about a spiffy show. Deacon Harold, first hour, and this hour, We've got Father Tad Boholczyk with us from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. It does tend to happen with these shows with Father Tad that a lot of the questions will go in one direction and then we'll kind of have a theme for the show, but you don't have to follow that theme. If you have any question about the treatment of a disease, if you have a question about the care of a family member or of yourself at the end of life, maybe you have pregnancy questions, bioethics questions about and anything from conception, from before conception to natural death, you're welcome to call with your question, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Father Tad is among the very best at this. He is a PhD in neuroscience, and he has a doctorate in ethics, and he's a priest of the Catholic Church. One other thing I should say, and then we will go to calls. The number 888-318-7884, and that is anybody can call. Look, if you have some bioethics issue, some health issue, some medical care issue that you need help with, that's what Father has dedicated his life to doing, and he's very happy to help. Maybe you would just like to hear the Catholic point of view so that you have something else to consider as you're making these decisions. 888-318-7884. All right. Enough of all that, and we will go to the phones. Let's see. Diane is in Hardin, Nebraska. Diane, give me a quick second. Let's see if we can get you on. Diane, you there with us?
Yes.
Diane, I'm awful glad you're here, but now I just realized that among the technical problems we're having, we might not have Father Tad with us. Oh, we do have Father Tad. Oh, I beg your pardon. My apologies. Diane, go ahead with your question for Father.
Well, as I'm listening to this, it's just so sad to me that we've just left God out of the picture and never talk about the healing power of God. And when my girls were young, back in the early 90s, there was a lady that wrote a book, and it was, "Is Your Bed Still There When You Close the Door?" And it had all kinds of things to visit with your kids about making decisions, moral decisions in life. Because at that time, that Dolly sheep, it was coming out that they were going to clone a sheep. And then where they went from there, it sounds like, is just unreal.
It does indeed. So... is that what you'd like, Father, to address, the idea that we ask and answer these ethical questions without reference to God?
Well, I guess that's my question. Yeah.
Okay. Father, what do you say about that?
Well, I would say that there are two levels that you can approach these kinds of questions on. The first level is indeed what we call a natural law level. In other words, a lot of times when you sort of feel in your gut that something's off, like the cloning case, oh, gee, you know, I don't think we should be cloning humans. That's maybe giving you insight into some, you know, important moral verities. And we need to be exploring a lot of our sense of repugnance around these issues. But, you know, even with that, people may still sort of forge ahead. And I think this is where it becomes important that we have God and the church to direct us. The church is so necessary in the sense that our wills are weakened by original sin, and we struggle, you know, against our own flaws in ways that we even will sort of not move towards what we know to be right. And so it's a real blessing that we have that authoritative guidance. And these complicated bioethical issues that come up in the church, it's always amazing to me. People will say, oh, well, the church is behind the times here and she's got to catch up. And, you know, she doesn't know how to handle the case of synthetic embryos. And I say, no, not true at all. That's not how it works. The church has been thinking about these things usually way before they happen. In vitro fertilization, first time it happened in humans was 1978. Pius XII in 1959 had already pointed out that IVF is something we should not be doing for humans. It's okay for livestock, but not for humans. Cloning, when Dolly the sheep was cloned, that was, what, 96? The church had already looked at this and pointed out it should not be attempted using human beings, in human beings. So, you know, the church is ahead of the curve here on these matters. And the matter of synthetic embryos, we have all the principles that we need to be able to move ahead with clarity around this. But the problem is, do we have people with ears to hear? That's more the question. And finding those ears to hear requires the grace of God, you know, the grace of teaching from the church to awaken consciences to the fullness of the truth.
Dan, your thoughts?
Oh, I guess a lot of this is new to me. The synthetic embryos, I had not heard of that before. So
right.
I do think that we do need to be educated into what is out there in the scientific world, I guess, that they're messing around with. It just doesn't seem morally right to me at all. So.
Well, certainly in that case, you would seem to be right on the money. I don't know, Father, maybe you would differ with me on this, but that doesn't seem to me a terribly hard case. I mean, creating through artificial means human lives that you have no intention of allowing to live seems to be immoral on a whole variety of different levels.
Yes, that's correct. And I mean, the church has indicated that we should only bring new human beings into the world in the marital embrace. And here you've stepped way away from that. You're basically manufacturing humans. And, you know, pretty soon it'll be humans growing in pods and, you know, artificial uteri and those kinds of things. I think that's the next twist in this unpleasant tale that's unfolding. So, yeah, we have what we need, really, to assess the moral wrongness of this. And as you point out, there are many other levels on which the synthetic embryo approach raises concerns. For example, just using stem cells that came out of embryos shouldn't happen, should not be done.
Right. Because that means you attacked a living human at their tiniest, most vulnerable moments.
Exactly. Yeah. That was the starting point for the whole thing.
Diane, thank you, and God bless you. I would like to just express my sympathy with the point you made about we need to teach children how to reason morally and how important moral reasoning is. Kelly's in Texas listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Kelly, awful glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Father Tad.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, we're happy to.
Earlier, Father, you said that if a human is created, that they have a soul. And I'm not sure if you meant to say that that was okay or not, but I'm wondering, how do you think about that whenever God is the creator? And if human beings have done the creation, is that a God-made soul? But then I think we're all co-creators with God, doing it the old-fashioned way. So is that the same thing? I don't know how to think about that.
Kelly, thank you.
Yeah, good question, Kelly. And I think what people sort of feel around this issue is, well, you know, if you're involved in really bad transgressions and you're sort of misusing God's creation in powerful ways, isn't God going to step in and sort of, you know, not allow it to occur and maybe not ensoul the embryo? It's a little bit like people, you know, thinking, well, gee, you know, atom bombs, I mean, they do have such devastating effects. You know, if we're going to be detonating this over a city of innocent civilians, wouldn't God step in and prevent the nuclear reaction from occurring? Well, you know, it'd be nice maybe, but that's not how God works. God respects the order of creation that he has set in motion. And so if we start splitting atoms, you know, around innocent civilians, there's going to be some terrible consequences. If we start, you know, mixing and matching stem cells and forming embryos, or if we start doing human cloning, as we have been doing, there are researchers who do that work as well. They've created cloned embryos with you know, numerous times. Those embryos, if they were given the opportunity to continue to grow, they are real embryos. They have all the characteristics that you and I have. They are members of the same family. So God is going to respect his biology that he has set in motion, even though he gives us as humans this terrible power to transgress objective goods and to do harmful things intentionally, even at times. So, you know, that's the nature of evil. It's a world that has a lot of evil that pops up in different ways, sometimes through our direct agency, sometimes more indirectly. But God doesn't step in and say, you know, I'm not going to ensoul, or I'm not going to allow the nuclear bomb to go off, or I'm not going to allow this other evil to transpire. I'm rather going to call people through the church and through my son, Jesus Christ, to conversion and a change of heart so that they will not choose to go down these dark pathways.
Kelly, I have to go to the break, so I will leave that there. I do hope that that was helpful to you. You're always welcome to call back again as more questions come up. I have to take a break, back with more bioethics questions for Father Tad Poholchik on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You know, I have never seen women who want to be equal absolutely degrading themselves. And yet the media degrades your nature, your beauty as a woman, your goodness. Let us pray. At some point, our dear Lord touches their hearts.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Now the phones are so busy. We've got lots of folks on the line with bioethics questions for Father Tad Poholchik from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Go down to Australia now. Jacob is in Australia listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Jacob, good morning. Go ahead with your question, please, for Father Tad. Jacob, I'm sorry. Now you can go.
Am I coming through?
You're coming through now, yes.
Oh, perfect. Okay, so my question is, this came up for me when I was watching the Destiny debate with Trent Horn. So if we kind of accept as Catholics that life begins at conception, what does that mean about the law? Because Destiny brought up that that would probably imply doing a criminal investigation any time that there's a miscarriage, or just using the law needing to the law would really need to impose on women who are pregnant in order to make sure that they're looked after the child from the moment of conception. So what position do we take on that? Because it does kind of sound like there would be this implication that the law would need to get involved any time there's a potential miscarriage or something along those lines.
So interesting concept there that you're raising. I'm not sure that I would agree that this implies some kind of requirement for us to, track individual pregnancies in some fashion. I think rather what it says is, if you have abortion places of business that are, you know, trying to operate underground, that you're going to be very actively pursuing that. And if you have, you know, some other very strong indications of ongoing abortive actions, then yes, the hand of the law is going to step in and investigate and check. But simple miscarriages, the fact that, you know, a woman was pregnant and then the child dies and she says, you know, that she lost the pregnancy and you have no other reason to doubt that, you know, there's no other circumstantial evidence that would raise suspicions. I don't think the law is going to be drawn in on that level. I think, you know, the pregnancy ended, happens with some frequency, regrettably, naturally, but I don't think that would actually be, I think you're sort of presuming a kind of overextension of the law here that would go well beyond what those who craft the laws would be envisioning for the particular statutes.
If I may, Father, it would seem to be that we have evidence of that because people die every day without law enforcement getting involved.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, even at the end of life, unless somebody comes up and says to you, well, I think my grandmother was poisoned, and here's the reason I think she was poisoned in the nursing home, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and I have this much evidence, and, you know, we need to start investigating. Well, then, yeah, then a process could be opened. But otherwise, you know, if grandma dies, grandma dies, and you don't just have her being tracked by the long arm of the law as her condition is deteriorating.
What do you think, Jacob?
Yeah, that's a pretty good answer. I mean, that's the one that I would accept myself, but I've just heard this point get brought up quite a bit, and yes, I just wanted to see if there were any additional insights, but I think he's correct. I think Fudd's correct about that.
Well, Jacob, thank you very much for the call from Australia. Some of us will be down in Perth, Australia. I don't know if you're anywhere near there, but if you're in the neighborhood, I hope you'll come and say hello when we're down there. When are we going to be down there? The second week of October. I'm going to just keep moving quickly, though, because there's so many people who want to talk to Father. Christine's in Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Christine, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Father Tad Boholczyk.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Happy to, Christine.
I work for a secular healthcare organization and was at a lecture last week by a local Catholic university professor on Catholic bioethics. There were several things that he said that surprised me and confused me, and I'll just bring one of those questions up today.
Okay.
So he said in a situation where a woman presents to a Catholic hospital for Plan B, that it's okay for Plan B to be provided to the woman because it would be considered self-defense. And then he gave two conditions that they could, if they wanted, do a pregnancy test, or if they were even more conservative, they could do a ovulation test, but implied that both of those things were unnecessary and were being very rigid.
Christine, I think just a vital word got dropped, but I assume we're talking about in the case of rape. Is that what you were?
Yeah.
Okay. There was just a technical glitch. Father, how do you respond?
So definitely it is possible to take steps to defend oneself from the ongoing effects of a rape in the sense of the sperm that are may still be present in the reproductive tract, you can take steps to repel them and keep them away from the woman's eggs. That would be allowable. Now, I would not agree with what that Catholic ethicist said to you, that it's completely optional about whether you should do ovulation testing and a pregnancy test. I would say the ovulation test in particular is important to do, because what you want to do is have your best sense of where the woman is in her cycle. And as long as she has not ovulated, you can take Plan B, which has an anovulatory effect, and prevent her from releasing an egg. That would be fine. But what if she has ovulated? Then that egg is released and the attacker's sperm may meet that egg and a new human being would be created. But it turns out that Plan B has another effect, which is that it may thin the lining of the uterus so that new embryo that was just created is not able to implant himself or herself and ends up dying. And that would constitute an abortion if one had taken Plan B in that fashion without doing testing to achieve moral certitude that the woman had not yet ovulated. So that would be the difference that I would, you know, emphasize. It is allowable to use Plan B in a Catholic hospital, but there should really be luteinizing hormone tests at a minimum, or other types of testing that would indicate whether or not she has ovulated, or give you some data on that, along with the fact that she may be able to give you her menstrual history, you know, as partial assistance in making these determinations.
Christine, does it make sense?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. I appreciate that because, as I said, the bioethics covers a whole range of things, and it's nice to have a great variety of questions. Thank you for bringing that one. Christina is in Charleston, South Carolina, listening on 760 AM. Christina, you are very welcome here. Go ahead with your question for Father Tad Poholchik.
Thank you. When I was younger, I thought that I wanted to die in my sleep because that sounded very peaceful. And I was told that, no, you don't, because at the hour of your death is when you're most vulnerable to the demons trying to attack you. And so when I'm thinking about my grandmother who recently died, she was in a lot of pain. And so they were giving her painkillers on a 24-hour cycle. And it seems to me that while we are trying to prolong life through science, there's also a point where that quality of life is just not there. And I don't mean she couldn't run around and talk. I mean that just because they were keeping her alive with, you know, her brain function, she wasn't cognizant enough to, you know, pray or even understand who she was.
So
I'd like to understand your thoughts on that line of bioethics, where just keeping somebody alive but not tending to their soul doesn't seem to me like it's really ethical.
Okay, well, Christina, I think it's some of the conclusions maybe that you offered could be examined a little further. I mean, for example, saying that because somebody is unconscious that they have no awareness around them, that may not be the case. You know, sometimes people who are in comas do remember some things from the time that they were under. And they say, for example, that when you are taking a lot of pain meds and, you know, maybe your general sense of things is you're very numb, you're sort of not really very aware, but your sense of hearing is one of the last things to go. So, you know, there may be people around you who are saying things, and you're, you know, I just heard a story from somebody recently who she went to visit her mom. She was the last of, I think, 8 kids. And she said, my mom was holding on. She was unconscious, basically, but it seemed clear to me that she was holding on, because when I got there and she heard my voice, you know, I was the last one in among the kids. Almost as soon as I walked out of the room, she died. And, you know, and I had to come from a great distance. So the question of, you know, what happens when we're in these states where we're semi-conscious, unconscious, etc., I think it's better to just sort of err on the side of, you know, for example, people who may be in comas, don't leave the TV blasting in the room, you know, thinking, oh, they can't hear anything. I mean, that may be very uncharitable for them to have to listen to that 24/7, et cetera. In other words, assume that there still is some responsiveness. I remember another person who was dying, and a family member came in and met and whispered in her ear about the birth of her great-grandchild, and a tear ran down her eye. Nothing else moved, but the tear, you know, she heard and understood in some way, and that tear came forth, you know, tear of joy. So I think, you know, what you're saying, though, also, and what I hear in your question is you don't want to be doing too much for people and sort of stringing them out excessively. And that's true. The Church teaches we only have to use ordinary or proportionate means we don't have to do heroics at the end of life. So that's going to be a separate question. We should be reasonable in the care that we provide to the ones that we love who are dying.
Christina, you brought us right to the end of the show, so I will say thank you and leave it there. Father Tad, may we have your blessing before we go.
Yes, of course. May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father. I really enjoyed the hour. I appreciate it.
Well, I enjoyed it too. Thank you so much, Si.
Tomorrow, 2 hours of open forum. See you then, God willing, at Catholic Answers Live.